You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Melody Thomas Scott is my guest this week. She's been a stripper. She's committed murder. She had venereal disease. She was kidnapped. She was married and married and married again. She's been to rehab. She escaped from rehab. She's been to prison, but only for a while. She's been seriously ill several times, and all these things and more as Nikki on the daytime drama The Young and the Restless. In addition to starring on that show for over 40 years, Melody Thomas Scott has appeared in many films and has expertly played the $25,000 pyramid. Melody Thomas Scott has written a memoir, Always Young and Restless, My Life On and Off, America's number one daytime drama. Melody Thomas Scott, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction. I was glad that you finished that phrase as Nikki, because that could be rather terrifying if I actually had done all of those things.
I want to ask you a question. What if you walked into your house and you saw sitting on the couch a man that slightly resembled your husband from the day before? And as you're thinking about it, a voice comes out of nowhere and says, you know, the part of Edward Scott will now be played by, and then would that freak you out? Or would that be, oh no, you're used to that?
Well, who would it be played by? You?
Yeah, it could be me. Probably played by Gary Shapiro.
Wow. I have never been asked that question. I don't know.
You just take it in stride because it happens every day on the show. Or not every day, but.
Well, you know, I mean, I am used to Eric Braden. After all these years, I better be.
Well, I want to, there's so much to talk about. And your book is a great book, a really wonderful book. And I appreciate you sending it to me. And I really loved reading it. I want to ask you, you've gone back to work now. The show is back on the air. How are you doing it safely?
Well, it's tricky. We forget all the time that we're not allowed to hug or even sit and chat. We have COVID experts on the set watching over us to make sure that we don't do things that we're not supposed to do. And it's just so easy to forget because we are a family and we haven't seen each other in 4 months. So it's like, oh yeah, you want to hug and chat, and we can't. So for now, we have to be as safe as we can, and production is making sure of that. We don't even go in each other's dressing rooms to run lines anymore. Everything is very regimented and weird. Very Twilight Zone, but it has to be for now. At least everyone is so thrilled to be back in production, and I know the fans are as well.
Oh, I mean, I was really enjoying the old shows that they were showing. That was kind of fun.
I know, weren't they fun?
Yes, yeah. But it was, and I saw that on your, I've only seen your first new show, but you were all very far apart from each other.
I haven't seen it yet. I've been a little busy doing press for my book. Oh. But I can't wait to see it because I'm curious how the angles, you know, the camera, everything is new. And so I am very curious to see how that came off.
It was very good. It's no problem.
But, you know, I think the viewers certainly are aware of the new restrictions that we have. So they would accept probably anything just to have us back.
There were some questions about soap operas that I've always had. And now here I'm talking to you, so I can ask them. And they came up in your book. Like you were mentioning that there were storylines that you didn't like, or that even more than that, there was characters who have been on your soap or other soaps that left the show and they didn't even ever find out why they were fired or why their characters were written off. Is there a hierarchy that you know you don't get to communicate with the powers that be that make the show, or how does that work?
Well, I think very often if a head writer has used your character to the point that he wanted to use it and can't really think of anything down the road for them. It can be a pretty brutal, oh, by the way, today was your last episode. I guess they don't want to tell the actors in advance because then it would affect their last few days performance. And, you know, you don't want to have all that in your head.
So even if you're going to die, they don't tell you until you die.
No, I think that kind of thing used to happen years ago, but no, I mean, I have not. Well, yes, I have died on the show, but I've always come back. As far as I know, in recent years, if somebody's going to die, the actor playing that character knows it.
What was your audition like for The Young and the Restless?
It was all very basic. I was just a freelance actress going on interviews every day. And this was merely one of them. I didn't have any excitement about it. I had never watched The Young and the Restless. I knew nothing about it. And in fact, I had just that same week gotten a role on a sitcom pilot that NBC was doing called Highcliffe Manor. And because it was a comedy, I wanted to do that. And when I got Young and Restless 2, my agent had to explain to me, you know, legally, if an actor is offered two different contract roles in the same week, the actor has to pick only one. You can't do both. And when she sat me down and told me that, I said, well, I want to do the sitcom. And she had to work pretty hard to convince me to not do the sitcom, to do Y&R. And she was throwing out things like, you know, job security, well, the job security is not exactly true. Financial, you know, stability and becoming part of a company. And she threw out all those things. And I was like, and she just wouldn't stop. She just kept working on me. And certainly she was right. And had I done the pilot never got past the pilot stage. So
yes. Highcliffe Manor is not in its 40s.
Yeah, no. So definitely that was the right decision.
In your book, you talk a little bit about this, but so as an actress, you had been in a lot of films, which I want to talk with you about in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you were doing a lot of television and you were on the Waltons and other things. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that it was a step downward to do daytime television? Was there a cast of, I don't mean like a cast in a play, but I mean cast as in society, that you were stepping, you know, you were doing daytime drama, which wasn't as good as films or.
You know, that never occurred to me. Either I was unaware of that, stigma, or I just didn't even think about it. And my agent didn't guide me away from it for that reason. So, I was happy she was right. I was happy to have a regular job. I was happy that I was now being paid every week to go into a studio every day and do what I love to do. I would have done it for free. Don't tell anybody. So, no, I was really pretty much unaware of the stigma for a long time.
I think, although you did end up doing this one show for so long, you've had the opportunity to do so many different things on the show, you know, that I mentioned earlier.
Well, and I think that I've been happy there for all these years because Nikki is such a versatile character and she gets mixed up in so many different storylines where she essentially gets to play another character under that guise of the umbrella of Nikki Newman. So I've never had a chance to get bored because of that. So I don't feel that I've only played one role. Yes, it has been Nikki, but I feel that she's taken me in so many different directions that it's still satisfying as an actor.
And Nikki is a completely different Nikki now. I mean, you know, you were a young stripper,
you delinquent. Can say it, yes.
Yeah, and now you're the matriarch of the family, right?
Well, I guess if you stick around long enough, that's bound to happen.
Do you think that you would continue to do the show as long as the show is there?
Well, as I've always said, I will continue to do the show as long as I'm happy there. because why leave? I mean, I'm so fortunate. This show really altered the trajectory of my life in that, yes, it gave me a wonderful job and changed my life, driving a better car, wearing better clothes. But it also gave me my husband. I met my husband on the show. I have my children because of the show. So it really was fated, I believe.
When you came to The Young and the Restless, it was kind of the golden age of daytime drama. There was many of them on all the networks, and your show expanded to an hour, and there was a lot of hour longs, and there was some of them had been on from radio, you know, had been on for decades. Mm-hmm. And you pointed out in your book something that I never considered, that the O.J. Simpson trial made a huge difference, and that has sort of changed the landscape of television.
It really did. We certainly weren't aware of that at the time. And we were all watching OJ too. The whole world was watching OJ every day, which preempted a lot of programming during the day, not just soap operas, any kind of daytime show. But we never really thought about losing ratings or that people might not come back. Maybe they've gotten out of the habit of sitting down at 1 o'clock every day and watching their story. But of course, that it did make a big difference, and ratings were lost all across the board, never to return in the high numbers that they were. So what are you going to do? You know.
Yeah. Well, it's fortunate that the soap you were on is the one that's it's still there.
Oh, we are so blessed that we are still number one and still on all over the world in many different countries, different languages. So we're still enjoying great success, in spite of OJ.
Yes, he's, well, many of your co-stars were on other soaps before, and All My Children and so on, came, yeah, and they were lucky they came to, Young and the Restless.
Yes, they are. I think so.
Well, your book is a lot of laughs, and it's full of wonderful stories about working on the show, but it's also, you know, a pretty serious book about, some serious topics. Was it uncomfortable to write about those? And what about now that you're doing a book tour? Is it all right to talk to you about those things?
Of course. I wouldn't have included it if I was afraid of the topic. And I've known for many, many years that I had a book in me that people should read. With all the adversity that I experienced in not your usual ways, I had a very unique story to tell, and I just had to get old enough to feel that I had all of that emotion under control before sitting down to write it. However, once I did decide, okay, I'm ready, for whatever reason, my brain decided to write some of the more dark chapters first, maybe to get it out of the way, I don't know, and then all of a sudden I started having panic attacks. And agoraphobic attack. So that was my mind letting me know, not so fast. You know, we're still dealing with this in here, and it never leaves you. You know, it stays with you forever. But you know, I had a few false starts for that reason, and then suddenly one day I just woke up and I turned to my husband in bed and I said, I'm ready to finish it. And I was, and it's been a very interesting journey. And the book, talking to you and so many other journalists, it's been very interesting to keep touching on that. But I mean, that really was the point of the book. I would never have sat down and written a book just about Young and Restless. I had to have something to say. And if I can help anybody else out there going through adversities of their own, give them encouragement, give them hope, then that's worth it all.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Melody Thomas Scott. She's the author of a new memoir called Always Young and Restless, My Life On and Off, America's number one daytime drama. She plays Nikki on Young and the Restless. Melody Thomas Scott, your grandmother raised you and acted as a stage mother in your early career, and in your book, Always Young and Restless, you describe how she encouraged you to be very nice to men who might benefit your career, and not nice in a healthy way for a young girl, certainly.
Well, I mean, certainly there are other things that I did not include in the book, But I think what is included gives the reader a good idea of what kind of emotional mayhem I was living with in her. And I've been asked, you know, what do you think her diagnosis would have been? I think in my readings and my research, I think that my grandmother was at the very least borderline personality, probably along with a few other things thrown in, because it just so irrational, prone to raging, screaming, hysterical, and you just never knew when that would kick off in her. But also to what you were just asking me, I think she, I mean, not to the extreme that she was, but I think a lot of new showbiz moms who may not be from Los Angeles or New York, they're not as savvy as somebody who's, you know, navigated the business for a while. I think that they're so ambitious for their child that, well, I don't know. I think my grandmother was an extreme case. I can't imagine any other parent being aware of this kind of abuse going on and not protecting their child. So I think that mine was a very unique situation, but you know, it does help to get to know the climate that you're in. Don't trust people with your child. This is your child. Just because you have visions of fame and, you know, money, you know, it's not worth it. The kid will tell you that. But yeah, it's interesting.
You even mentioned in a beauty pageant that you were in, mm-hmm. that you had to kiss the judge, but apparently it wasn't enough because someone else won the beauty pageant. What did they have to do?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know. All of us girls who were involved, it wasn't just one beauty pageant. That was a group. That was like a troop that went on for years. And we would have a pageant, I think, 3 or 4 times a year.
And how old were you then? You were like 9?
I think that started when I was 8. So 8 to 11, maybe. I find that when you're a kid in this business, or even an adult, this type of thing is more likely to happen in an environment where you're not really in show business. You're on the fringe of show business. And these people who abused me, they were not legitimate producers, directors. They, I'm sure, just created this, you know, Hollywood Children's Theater, Junior Stars of America. They create this to attract children, hopefully not from Los Angeles, who aren't too savvy, so that they can have their way with them.
So they're predators, essentially.
Absolutely.
Well, Melody Thomas Scott, I have to say that Tippi Hedren was on the show here not too long ago. So therefore, you are the second guest that I've had to have played Marnie in Alfred Hitchcock's Marnie.
I guess so, yes.
That was your first film, Marnie?
My first feature.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And with Alfred Hitchcock, that must have been something. I mean, did you know who Alfred Hitchcock was at all?
Had no, not a clue. To me, he was just another director. I had no idea. And albeit a scary one, you know.
Yeah, I bet.
Especially when you're a kid, it's like,
Well, he was scary to Tippi Hedren as well, as it turns out. But
yeah.
what was it like working on the set with him? Do you remember?
Well, you know, his demeanor and just the way he breathed very loudly. He never smiled. He wasn't one to, you know, chat with a child actor. I don't think he was one to chat with adult actors from what I've read, but just a very imposing guy, and all you wanted to do was please him, do your job, and go home. You know, come back the next day, maybe he'll be a little better, but no. And he always wore the same exact thing. I don't know if I was the only kid who noticed that. He always wore a black suit, white shirt, black tie, and he must have had 20 of them at home, because every single day same. But just so very scary. And if I mean, I found myself in the position of not pleasing him and him having to continue to correct me how he wanted me to play the scene. And it was very stressful, very stressful.
I never see Nikki wearing the same thing. Does Nikki wear something? Okay, what happens to the clothes?
See, Nikki could have taught Hitchcock a few things there.
Do you get to keep the clothes? Do you have a huge closet of Nikki's clothes?
I don't get to keep the clothes per se. They always, after I'm done wearing them at work, they go up into the big wardrobe room at CBS. But, you know, if I'm doing a personal appearance or I'm doing a talk show or something, I can certainly borrow anything that I want from wardrobe. So I don't really care which closet it's in. If it's at CBS or mine, I still get the opportunity to wear it.
But maybe Melody Thomas Scott's style and Nikki's style are not exactly the same.
You are absolutely right there. But some of the things, maybe what I wear for a personal appearance might not be my style either, but it's what the fans, how they want to see me.
How did it come that your grandmother was in charge of you when you were a little girl?
Both my parents were 16 when I was born. Family insisted that they get married just for the child. And neither one had any interest in being a parent. And really, I was born at Cedars. And the day that I went home from the hospital, I went to my grandmother's house. There was no other house that I lived in. So, that was going to be my lot in life until I could pull it together and grow up enough to move out, which I always knew. I always knew there's something very wrong with the people here in this house. And maybe when I was six, I figured out the only way I'm going to get out of here is to age out. I didn't know that term, but I knew that I had to age out.
Did you have another set of grandparents that were in your life too?
No.
So it was just your grandmother. And so you're a rare thing. You're a Los Angeles native. There's not very many Los Angeles
natives. I am. Well, my husband is a Santa Monica native. So for both of us to be married, it's very unusual to have
a dynasty.
Yeah.
and you're on a soap that has always filmed in Los Angeles. A lot of the soaps filmed in New York.
Oh yeah, true.
Yeah, interesting. So I want you to tell the story from your book that I loved so much, because I love John Cassavetes. He's one of my favorite people, and I love that movie, The Fury.
Oh, did you?
Oh yeah, what a great movie.
Oh, I'm so happy.
And I love him. I think he's just a remarkable and interesting guy. And I was so pleased to know that he really was a cool guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was great to us.
So tell me about with King Tut.
Well, we were shooting in Chicago. And I can't remember if Chicago was the first U.S. city that the King Tut exhibit came to. I want to say it was, but maybe it was just such a big deal in Chicago. So we were all aware of it. The whole city was talking about it. We knew with our shooting schedule, we were never going to be able to go see it. But in the meantime, Cassavetes was always treating the cast to amazing Italian restaurants. He seemed to know Chicago like the back of his hand. And he was just such a wonderful host, and he would always do that for us. So one Saturday, I believe it was, he took us out to another incredible restaurant, and the studio vans would take us there. Transportation department would take us to the restaurants. Well, when we left the restaurant that night, about 11:30, we got back in the car, but we were told we are not going back to our hotel yet. That when we get to the destination, which is a secret, that we were to be quiet and just follow instructions and no laughing, no giggling, no making noise. We thought, what's Cassavetes up to? Had no idea that he had, well, I'll continue with the story. So our vans pull up. It's midnight now. We pull up to a service entrance in the back of the Field Museum. And again, we are warned, be quiet, no talking. Security guard that apparently new Cassavetes, or, you know, a lot of things had to happen. Arrangements had to be made somehow that started with Cassavetes. We went through a series of hallways. We're now in the back of the museum. We go out into the main hall of the museum. And then at one point we had to step over or under invisible beings that, you know, they use as alarms in the museum. Well, this was just like unbelievable. And I know this sounds absolutely insane, like some kind of science fiction movie, but I was there. I wouldn't believe it if I had not been there myself. We did indeed see the King Tut exhibit. Then we turned around, we traced our steps again, very quiet, no talking. The security guards would open doors for us. We quietly go back into our waiting van in the parking lot and go back to the hotel. So that was, as you can imagine, the most memorable film experience.
Yeah. So Brian De Palma, who directed The Fury, was so influenced by Hitchcock and took so much of his style from Hitchcock. And here you worked with both directors. What was it like to work with De Palma?
Oh, absolutely wonderful. By far my favorite film director. He's a good guy. He wants to stay true to his vision, which is always, you know, his vision is like perfect always. And he knows how to make his cast and crew work for him to give him the best possible performance production for him to fulfill his vision. And that's not easy to do. A lot of good directors can be screaming maniacs on the set to get what they want to get. But De Palma is different. He does it all with kindness. And I just was so impressed with him. I'm so thrilled that I've worked with him.
And John Wayne's last film is one of the great last films of any actor. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, the last scenes of the movie where he's sort of saying goodbye to life, and he's riding on this streetcar, and there's this beautiful little girl there, and she says, "Oh, what a beautiful day it is," I think she says, or something like that. And that is you. You're the last woman to have ever appeared on screen with John Wayne.
Yeah, which I would never have put together. It took a film crew from Japan that came and wanted to talk to me in my dressing room at CBS many years ago. And oddly, they told my publicist they wanted to focus on the shootist, which had not been a common request. But I thought, you know, okay, that'll be fun. And they were so nervous and sweating and trembling really around me. And I didn't know what was going on. And then eventually it came out that, well, the cameraman asked if he could touch my arm. And, I looked over at my publicist on the other side of the room, and, you know, he's like, okay. So I let him touch my arm, and he starts crying. Tears are coming down from his eyes.
Wow.
And that was when we heard, and I had no idea of this, that the Japanese worship John Wayne because he was so Americana and the American hero. And even to this day, they feel this way. And so they, of course, studied his films very carefully. And they had worked out, this is why the guy touched me. That's this guy, the guy was crying. They were shaking because they had to tell me, you are the last female actress to appear with John Wayne. And at first I thought, well, no, I'm not. You know, I mean, Lauren Bacall was in that movie. They said, no. They're going chronologically in what you just said. But I had no idea. So in Japan, I guess I'm famous, not for the work I've done, but who I worked with.
Well, John Wayne is a fine actor, and he gives you a very, it's a kind of a complex scene because he gives you a very loving, but paternal look, you know, that couldn't be misconstrued. I think it's a well-directed movie for sure.
Oh, it was Don Siegel. Don Siegel was the greatest.
So tell us a little bit about that day. I mean, how long did it take to shoot, and what did John Wayne say to you between takes or whatever?
Oh, he was just sweet as can be. He really was just a big teddy bear, but bigger than life. And I always say he knew how to be a movie star. You know, when we had movie stars, it was different. And he just, he was so kind. I remember when I first met him, He came out of his motorhome to shake my hand, and oh my gosh, he was just this massive, tall, huge movie star. And he took my hand in his, and it was like a bear claw. But I also noticed in that same moment, he was wearing a copper bracelet that back then a lot of people who were sick, and he had already been diagnosed with cancer. The whole company knew this. And he was wearing one of those. And so it was kind of like, oh, what a wonderful, incredible moment. But then the bracelet kind of took me back to earth of, oh, you know, let's see what happens here. And sadly, yes, that was his last film. And you know, in the movie, he dies of cancer as well.
Aided by a bunch of bullets. But
Well, that's true, but he had cancer. You're right.
He's dying. Yeah. No. I love that movie, and it's wonderful to have that in your as part of your resume, I guess.
It is a great movie. I love doing it, and I'm honored to have been a part of it.
What about Kirk Douglas? You have a good story about him. You did a movie with him, another Western, I think, right?
Yes. Yes.
And he hired you on the spot.
He did, which an actor's lucky for that to happen once in their career. I think it's happened to me four times and it's not supposed to. But I had been out of the business for several years. I was no longer a kid. I was chubby. My hair was all different colors. I certainly was not camera ready. And out of the blue, I was contacted by my childhood agent. And as if no time had passed, she said, "Hi, honey, here's an address I have for you. Take this down for an interview." And I just said, "Okay." And the next day, I didn't know who I was meeting with. I wasn't given a name of the casting director or anything. I show up in this office. The receptionist says, "Oh, yes, I'm the only actress there. There's nobody else in the waiting room." And she says, "Okay, he'll see you now." And I walk in. I'm in someone's office, and sitting behind the desk is Kirk Douglas, which I had no idea that was who I was going to be meeting. And he starts telling me about this Western that he's directing and starring in. And I think he was looking at my hair like, "Oh my God, you know, what a mess that is. What can we do?" And he asked me, you know, "Do you know how to braid hair?" And I said, "Sure." And, he said, "Well, so do I." And he jumped up from his side of the desk and came over and sat down and started braiding my hair, which, back then that was an innocent thing. I thought nothing of it. If that happened today, I'd probably think, back up. But it was just this sweet thing that he did. Maybe he was thinking that that's how I would wear my hair in the film, which I did not. But after the hair braiding, he said, "Well, you have the part." No script, no scenes. I didn't have to
read anything. Read anything.
Like one of those things. See, fate stepped in again. I'm sorry?
Was it a good part?
Oh, no, it was a tiny part. It was next to nothing. But as often is the case on location or just on any shooting schedule, that tiny bit that you see me in that film, I was on location for a month. It was a long location for so little work on my part.
Wow. And in The Shootist, you're only in it for a moment, but was that shot in California or in Carson City?
Carson City.
And how long were you on location there?
About 2 days.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Warner Brothers didn't have all that money to waste on keeping me there for a month, I guess.
Well, maybe he wanted Kirk Douglas wanted you around in case he felt like braiding your hair again.
Oh, well, he never did, though. He was a little busy directing a movie and starring in it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with the star of The Young and the Restless, Melody Thomas Scott. She's just written a book called Always Young and Restless, My Life On and Off, America's Number One Daytime Drama. Melody Thomas Scott, do you miss making movies?
We get kind of spoiled working as fast as we do in daytime. You know, there is no other part of this business that works as fast. We do between 80 and 120 pages a day.
And how do you learn all your lines?
You just do. It becomes very easy.
You don't have an earpiece of somebody telling you.
No, that would never work. No, but
cue cards.
No. Back in the day, way, way long ago, we did have cue cards, but no, we haven't had them for decades.
I was really intrigued in the book where you talked about going off script occasionally. In
scene. Oh, yes.
And they don't immediately say, cut, that's not in the script. No, they just let you do it.
They will let us do it as long as it furthers the emotion of the scene, or perhaps, God forbid, we make it a little better than was written. Because in the end, they just want it to be the best scene possible. And often Eric and I, we are pretty similar in the way we work. We will kind of go, and we don't talk about it ahead of time. We don't say, okay, listen, instead of this line in the script, I'm going to say this, and then you're going to say that. We don't do that. It's kind of just an unspoken thing that while we're rolling, he'll say something not quite what he's supposed to say. And then depending on what that was, I'm going to respond. I'm not going to respond with the dialogue. I'm going to respond with what my heart and head tells me Nikki how she would respond. So often that will happen. And the control booth is very aware that we have gone off script, but they don't stop because, you know, most of the time we're creating a better scene right there on our feet.
How come you've never had an evil twin that just surfaced out of that's puzzling.
I think it's puzzling too. And I would love that. That has yet to happen for me. And I think I'm one of the few actors on the show that it hasn't happened to. And I also would love for Nikki to go stark raving mad and end up in a rubber room. And wouldn't that be so much fun to play? And the writers know that. And that has not happened either. So I think
Had amnesia? Your character ever had amnesia for any length of time? Amnesia. That's another soap bubble.
I don't think so.
You know, it's funny. I've never met anyone in real life who's ever had amnesia or had an evil twin.
No, you're right. Me either.
I always think
they must be out there somewhere.
I always think it's interesting that Genoa City or Pine Valley or any of those places in the soaps, they always have an international airport.
Yes.
And one diner.
You've been watching too many soaps, Gary.
Well, in your book, you talked about acting, starting out as an actress. You didn't care about being famous, that you just like acting. That was the thing that drove you.
Correct. And where I went into it a little more, I think, is I did mention that a lot of times young kids, young people who are interested in this business, they'll ask me for some tips. And the first question I ask them is, why do you want to be an actor? Because usually their answer is the wrong answer. They usually say they want to be rich and famous. And that is just the worst reason to want to go into this crazy business. You have to really love it. You have to have a passion for it. You have to want to do it whether you're paid or not. And a lot of people I've talked to, they don't like what I tell them, but I feel it's a dose of reality that they better know about before they get here, before they sell all their possessions and make their way across the country to Los Angeles. Hey, you got to know, it's a tough enough business. If you don't truly love it, you're going to be miserable.
When you're playing any part, but when you're playing Nikki, how aware are you of the stuff happening around you? I mean, how into it do you get?
Well, emotionally, I must believe every bit of the scene. Like if I have to cry or if I have to start screaming about something, I need to believe that that is real. On the other hand, I almost have a split brain. I'm a very technical actor, which makes Eric crazy. But I can't help but be aware of the camera over here and the boom up there and my mark here on the floor. And I'm also, while I am completely invested and believing in this scene, the other half of my brain is aware of all these other things. I don't know why that is. I have a wacky mind.
Did you study acting or it just came to you?
Oh, well, of course, I mean, from the time I was 3 years old, I was in acting classes. It wasn't just dancing, singing, horseback, jazz, ballet, you know, acting was always the priority.
Yeah. And can you do all those things? I mean, if called upon, is there anything that you, can you roller skate? Can you do anything?
Well, at my age now, I don't know that I would, but I probably could. No, I'm glad that my training taught me so much. And things like that really never leave you. I have put a pair of tap shoes on, and I can still tap dance. I don't think anybody wants to see it.
Well, they're going to work it into the show as soon as they hear this.
No, no, please.
And you've done some stage acting as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm really, when you're three, in order to prep for commercials, TV, ultimately films, the only way you can get experience is in theater. So that was my roots were in theater, and I still adore it. I love theater.
And you want to do physical comedy like Lucy.
I do.
Is that what, when Nikki is drunk, is there a little Vita Vegemin happening?
Oh gosh, why did that never occur to me? I would have done that. No, I didn't think of that. But I do think to play drunk, you have to just kind of loosen up your brain, your body, everything, and not really be too serious about anything. So your lines are not exactly right. You might be slurring a little bit. You might be walking a little funny. I always look forward to Nikki being drunk to ingest a little bit of comedy into the show, because comedy is sorely missed in daytime world, I think. But I never really thought about comparing it to Lucy. But if I get to be drunk again on the show, I'm going to think that.
You mean when?
When? Okay. I like that.
But you've drawn the line on stripping. You're done, unfortunately for me, you're done stripping on the show.
Yeah, sorry.
your scenes were pretty daring in terms of, like, I was watching on YouTube the one where you're in a restaurant and you suddenly take off all your clothes. Mm-hmm. And you're wearing a bustier of some kind, but it's pretty revealing.
Yes.
Were there any censorship issues? Did anybody say, you can't do that?
Not by the time we shot that. In the very beginning, before I knew anything, I got called into our executive producer's office, and I thought, the first time he sat me down and he said, how would you feel about Nikki being a mud wrestler? And at that time, wait, this is how long ago that was, in the 70s, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, that would be fun. Because I thought he was calling me in his office to fire me. So it was like, oh, I'd agree to anything, and that I wasn't being fired. Sure, mud wrestler, fine, no problem. And so I went up to Sunset and saw a couple of those shows for research just to see what it was all about. And then shortly after that, I get called back into his office because CBS had heard about the plan of me being a mud wrestler, and they nixed it. And then Bill Bell had an immediate idea after that, which was to be a stripper. So the original plan was for her to be a mud wrestler, not a stripper.
You talk in your book very interestingly about the double standard of male and female stars. If a man gets a couple of wrinkles and gray hair, he's ready to play the silver fox.
Mm-hmm.
And if a girl gets wrinkles and gray hair, she's ready to play grandma.
True.
And has that been a struggle for you?
It's never been a struggle for me at all. I mean, I started so young, and I've been in this business for the long haul, and I always thought, you know, one day I'll be playing the grandma, and I look forward to that. And of course, Nikki is a grandma now, but something very unexpected happened. As much as I wanted to age gracefully, I started noticing this three chin action, you know, from the profile on the shots of the show. And there was not even a glimmer of thought behind it. It was like, I saw it and I said, that is unacceptable. That is unacceptable, especially for Nikki. And I thought, I have to fix this because it really bothered me personally. So I do talk about it in the book. I did have it done. I had my neck and chin done, And I'm absolutely thrilled with it. I wish I had done it sooner.
I think I need to get your surgeon.
I'll give you his name.
Melody Thomas Scott. The book is called Always Young and Restless, My Life On and Off, America's Number One Daytime Drama. What a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the
Book. Oh, it was so fun speaking to you. We have to do it again.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.